This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by the things we make. If you want to support Gregory Kamichuk, you can go to gmbkamichuk.ca. And if you think Justin Curry is just all right, you can go to chasingartwork.com.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I am your host, Gregory Kamichuk, a working writer and illustrator that works in books and comics and graphic novels, and if it has words and pictures in it, I want to tell that story. With me is my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork, as well as producer extraordinaire Dan Vadaboncur. Just before the podcast started, we were talking about a bunch of things that are not ready for the podcast. So now, having had a riveting conversation with these two gentlemen, I wonder what there is left to talk about.
We blew it all. There's nothing left to talk about. See you guys later. I'm done.
We wasted our energy. And so all that is left for you, the dear listener, is the dregs of what is on our minds. That's all we have left. No, gentlemen, we're going in a few weeks, less than a few weeks.
8 days.
In 8 days. We're going on a book tour that takes us to the city of Calgary and then onward to the city of Saskatoon and a number of bookstores, comic stores, and places in between is usually what we do. Which ones are usually targets of opportunity along the way? And this, for some reason, feels different than the last time we went. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because there's a whole posse of us going.
Yeah.
There's more people in the circus.
You guys have done this. You say you've done this now, just before the pandemic, you started doing this, right? Like where you worked at kind of the appearances, because this is all about going to Calgary for the con.
We go to Calgary for the Calgary Comics Expo, which is 4 days long.
4 days.
And then we
Canada's second biggest show.
Yeah, second big show. It's a great show. Just if you're if you're into that stuff, and it's also a really good. It's a city that's interested in that stuff, and I think largely because the weird component of life skips Calgary most months of the year. They just avoid the conservative beating heart of Canada and go elsewhere. So when we descend, there's usually a hungry crowd that's like, ooh, interesting, weird things. So that's been good for us. And then the Saskatoon, we just love the city of Saskatoon, and that show is very well run. They've got a new people running it now. And the last time we were there, we were welcomed with open arms by the showrunners, and so we were pleased.
It's also on the way home, so going to Calgary is about a 13 and a half hour drive, and then heading back towards Winnipeg, our home base, you drive for 8 hours, then you hit Saskatoon, we have the show there, and then what, six? Basically it's on the way home. So rather than doing that 13-hour drive there and back, we get to split up the journey home and do another show. It makes it worth it.
And we usually set up creative projects. At least I do. I'm bringing a draft of a novel to work on while I'm there. I have the first draft done. I need to sort of tinker with it. I've got some
Working on a script too.
Creative projects. Yeah, we got it. And so there is
workation element.
Yeah, a workation element where I get to be with other workaholics who don't mind that we just will do nothing but work.
Right. Wait, something I wanted to maybe throw out there just to put into the conversation. You never arrive. You're never finished. You're never...
Like on the way to Calgary, you never
get
there.
Just...
Right. You never... Like that just kind of,
the road keeps... It does feel like when you're driving to your prairies, the road just keeps on going.
Journey as destination.
How as a creative, how as an artist, how as a human being, do you come to terms with the fact that you never cross that finish line? You never finish. You never have enough. You never do enough. There's always, the second you finish a project, you've already kind of started two or three other ones in your mind. But the whole time you're working on a project in your mind, you think that there's this magical finish.
This reminds me of an angry comment that got shot at me from the internet recently. Oh. I made the mistake of liking a comment on social media about how somebody made a comment that said, if we're using AI for everything, we might as well just stop thinking for ourselves and let the computers do it. And I thought it was funny. And I like clicked a like, and I guess whatever it is about the internet, that means I am now a target of hatred because
you put yourself out there.
Let's be clear.
Yeah. So anyway, you had this. You basically
put how this connects to your point about things being there is a person said, you know, you're so short-sighted and you're the worst. And I've looked at your artwork.
Not as a reply to a comment as a reply to you liking a comment.
That's right. Liking a comment. Not even reply. Right? Just a like a comment. Then they commented to me that you're the worst and you, I looked at your artwork and my AI can do better artwork than you can do. And so you're a dying breed. Right. And my reply is what comes to mind when you ask that question. My reply to that person was, your AI art probably is better than the art I'm doing. Computers are better at everything when compared to a person, but I'm not making art for the end point. I'm making it as a journey as an artist. The human experience of making the art is why I make art, not the end result. And so what I get from being alive while I'm making things is the reason I'm making art, not the piece that's at the end. And part of our business model is that it does produce things at the end. And so once they are made, you decide what to do with them. But that's not the reason to embark on the journey in the first place.
Well, to me, it is about finishing a project and starting a new one. That's the whole point, is to keep doing new things, keep trying new things, and just continuing to experience. That's all what it's all about to me.
Don't you guys have that part of your mind that goes, okay, if we do this, that, and the other, then like... then we can coast. Then we like...
well, maybe for a little bit.
Yeah, but it depends, I guess, what coasting means.
If you do that one project that is so uber successful that lights the world on fire, then you get to rest?
Never.
Not no. Forever. Even if it's something where you... what was it? Susie Maloney. You had Susie Maloney on, right?
Yeah.
She made $1 million by selling a script to Tom Cruise or something like that?
Yeah. I don't know if it was totally $1 million, but
it was a lot of money. Yeah. And that's... but sure, that happens. But she's still working. She's still having to... she's not like she was able to retire.
Yeah, because that was 20 years ago. Exactly. 25 years ago. Like, divide $1 million times 20 years. That's not a lot of money over...
it's,
you know,
a lot of...
you can't just... that's not, as they call it, FU money. Right? Right? You need $100 million if you want FU money these days.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sorry, I'm having a dame.
These people will remain nameless, but when I first started, I worked with a printer who would do my originals to canvas printing. And in their misspent youth, they had been assistants to Bruce Willis and Demi Moore.
Ooh.
That was, you know, they had now owned this business and had this other business. But when they were young, that's what they did. They worked as, you know, basically Pepper Potts's for rich folks in
Hollywood.
Imagine
they had some good stories.
They had some very good stories. And at the risk of defaming any of the people involved,
Bruce Willis.
One of the things that was really obvious in their stories was the way in which something William Gibson says also, that the ultra rich are no longer even remotely human in the way that they move through the world. The consequences do not stick to them in the same way. The, you know, expensive rental car, they park it on the sidewalk and walk away from it and then get on a plane and leave the city they were in, and it would be the assistants and someone else's problem.
I don't think it's their fault, because the world does not react to them like it does to normal people either.
That's right.
Right? When the world morphs around you in such a different shape than it does every other person, you can't help but become something different.
Right. So maybe that's what you're talking about, right? If you're hoping that your labor will result in some final form that allows you to be free
of concern. Let's just be clear. I'm just throwing it out there.
He's just trying to start trouble.
I never want to. That's like, I take comfort in that.
You tell everyone you're already retired.
Well, yeah.
You also have Chasing in the name of your brand.
Right. Chasing and a white whale, because Chasing the obsession that eventually killed poor Ahab. I take comfort in the fact that I'll never be done, that every project is a stepping stone for a better project that's the next one and the next one after that.
Yeah,
like, that's like the coolest thing about what we do. And like looking at other, like some other professions, like, you know, if you're doing something, like if you're a basketball player or a boxer, like you don't necessarily have that future, but we do as artists, like we only improve.
Where the hell can I get eyes like that?
Gotta kill a few people.
Okay, I can do it.
When I am teaching storytelling workshops, or like I'm teaching right now a after school program that works with grades 1 to 8 2 hours a night. We make up a story every night, a new story every night. I teach them the basic a basic structure, not the like apex structure of storytelling, but a basic storytelling structure.
Story structure.
No. I do someone somewhere wants something, a complication ensues with them, and I show them how those blocks can be filled in with anything you want, and you repeat it to make a good story. And as part of that instruction, I, in working in the classroom story, have started thinking about it in terms of role-playing game design and story structure. I call it the paradox path, the path you make by walking it, right? So when you're telling a story and you're trying to design a story, you don't worry about whether or not it goes anywhere yet. You just start generating ideas, people, places, things, and then the ones you like best, you go back, and then you thread your plot through those things, and now you have a story, right? Our lives are very much like that. We're making things. Once they exist, we figure out what they're for. Once we know what they're for, people will respond to them. The people who respond to them often provide us our next opportunity. And it's all about that fish. It's just swimming and taking in water in the gills. Yeah. You know, as soon as you stop swimming, then the whole machine stops.
And that's how you make a good story. You don't go, Johnny comes into the room, and then this happens. You make it, you know, he comes into the room, something happens which causes his next action, right?
That's
it's right. Not and then, and then, and then.
That's right.
We finish a project which causes this reaction, which makes us go in this direction,
it's not,
you know?
This and then that. It's this.
Because
therefore,
of that.
Therefore. Yeah.
Therefore.
Right? Yeah. Or if this, then that. It's like kind of our way of navigating. So, you know, it's interesting if I take the physical journey that we'll be on, like, just as people going on the road, going to all these different shows. There's a foregone conclusion there. We know where we'll be. We basically know what kind of people we're going to interact with. You can kind of put a certain part of your brain on autopilot if you've done it before. And I think that's the danger. One of the reasons why I like traveling with you, Justin, and a lot of the folks at the studio is that nobody here is taking it for granted how it's going to go. And we're all open to the possibility that what if this, what if that, what if this other thing? And that's what keeps it exciting. That's what keeps it fresh. And, you know, even in my advancing years, that's what keeps me feeling young and interested in the chase. You know, I don't like the word hustle because it feels like you're tricking people.
Hustling artwork?
Yeah, hustling artwork. Yeah, it's not quite the same, but the chase. The chase is...
Join the fight in Hustle Comics.
Yeah. No.
How's Meat House coming along?
Not at all. Well, here's what I'll say, and I was very excited about it, and I was very gung ho as far as I'm going to be done this by February. I haven't had time, and that is really, and I don't mean that as an excuse, but I actually knew you were going to ask me about this, so I prepared.
I was excited. I was thinking about Meat House.
It's going to happen. It is absolutely going to happen. But it's what it is. It's about dedicated time. Right now, I work in like increments of 1 hour, half an hour sometimes, as far as my tasks go. And I haven't had the hours, I would say, at least 3 hours or more, as far as a time block goes, to really sit down and write something.
But it's kind of good taking this time away from a project, because when you come back, you have those fresh eyes. It hasn't been living in your brain for a bit. So it's kind of like you're coming at it new, and you can recognize what's working well and what's not. So I kind of like leaving a writing project alone for a couple of weeks and coming back to it.
If you steal like from Taika Waititi's writing process, I mean, obviously he's quipping for talk shows, but he would say, he has said that his favorite thing to do is write the entire script, put it in a drawer, and not look at it again for a number of months, and then start again without looking at the first draft.
Oh, let's see how
based
it
only on what he remembers.
That's a good idea.
And that your memory is the good part, right? Because your mind responds to emotion, and your emotion pushes it into long-term memory. And so only the stuff that made you feel something are the parts you're going to remember. And so those are the parts worth writing down.
Yeah. So I do have a very basic story thought out. As far as beginning, middle, and end, and specific scenes. I have an outline and specific scenes, and kind of the more I think about it, the more these scenes get fleshed out. Like I have a really good opening scene, a good reveal scene as far as like when we find out what's going on and that kind of thing. So I do have these things, and they are in my mind. I just haven't written it down yet. So I think that I do need to just bite the bullet and start writing.
Yeah.
That is my goal. Now that I have more time because the school year is ending, I don't have to teach. Today was my last day of classes. Yay. So no more classes. I will absolutely have more time to sit down and actually work for a couple hours at a time to actually write. So that is my goal. And I still want to keep a long-term goal. So I'm going to say by the end of May, which I think is much more realistic. And it's still six months out from when we first thought about it. So I just don't want this to sit on the shelf for years. That's really the concern with procrastination and putting the thing off that you want to write, especially when it's not your job. Like, I have a job. I do something else. This is not what I do. So for me to find the time has been a challenge.
Just to be creatively expressive.
Right, right. And I also want to try going out and writing in public again. Have you been doing that? You used to like doing that.
I love writing in public. I haven't done it. I got out of the habit. So
right.
We kind of did it downstairs a little bit.
A little bit, I know, and I liked it. Okay, so for the dear listener, we had a First Friday in the Exchange in Winnipeg is an event that in the Exchange District in downtown Winnipeg, the first Friday of every month, studios and art spaces all over our downtown will open to the public. And it's sort of a...
And there's a brochure you can pick up that has a map and all the locations that have the open doors and...
Other cities do First Friday.
Right.
Yeah, it is a common thing. Yeah.
So we did a First Friday event and the building was really pleased with how it turned out, how we set up the space and asked... they were very gracious. They said,
They're even leaving your stuff down there. I saw as I came
in. You missed out the part. Like, on the first floor of our building, we're located on the 7th floor, but on the first floor, there is a massive raw space that is unfinished floorboards.
For 10 years,
walls.
It's been unfinished.
Really?
It's very, it needs a lot of work before any tenant's ready to move in, but it is storefront, like brick and mortar, like facing the street. And we took that over.
That's right. And it's across the street or across the hall from the new coffee shop that's in. So there's lots of foot traffic there in the building now, and it's been good. So all this to say, we've been open sort of 10 to 2-ish for a week and a half
asterisk, in that space.
Yeah. And during that time, I've been writing and working on projects again
in public. Okay. And so it's like having a little store.
But I'm looking forward to immensely that time on the road where – Justin and I will, and probably Lyndon and maybe Stephen, we'll all be together somewhere, and George McHale and his writing partner, with our headphones in, completely ignoring each other while we all write.
Right.
And it'll start with somebody working hard and the rest of us hanging out, but feeling that dread that, oh my God,
usually the first
Lyndon's
person
getting
that
ahead.
Opens their laptop and puts their headphones in starts a chain reaction of workaholics everywhere, right? Yeah, so... That's how it is. But when you have creative stuff, the only way to get it done is to put the time in.
Right, yeah. And so I feel like I do have to get out. I have to start a new routine. I can try and work it into my morning routine. That works for Chad Ginter, who we've had on the show. So I'm going to try that. And also, again, getting out to a coffee shop, sitting there and writing with other people around you and just kind of being in a public space. I really like that.
There's a great – if those distractions are not too much for a person, that can be really – really good, because when you're thinking about how do I describe this person, you just look up. What I do is I just look up and I type a description of someone I can see.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it transposes itself into the prose. And, you know, that all gets anything that doesn't work gets shaken out in the second or third draft.
What is it now?
Like I said, it ain't me you gotta worry about.
I recently did a rewrite for a film project where I got brought into an existing script, gave notes on it, and then did some rewrites on that script. And while I was doing that, I started poking around at some other people's sort of anecdotal stories about that. I thought maybe it would be a good podcast episode. I wasn't sure. And I found somebody's writing advice, which maybe would work for you. If you're having trouble getting started on a movie, download a script to a film that you think is close to the movie that you would want, and then a scene at a time, rewrite over it.
Yeah, I could do that.
Delete and edit the parts like, oh, this person's talking. Well, no, that'll be my character. You rename it. Then you put in different dialogue. And then when the scene description comes up, you type your description and you eradicate someone else's work in favor of yours. And it helps get the steam up and gets the wheel turning. And I thought, I've never done that. Sounded exciting to me.
You know, you're describing exactly what I do when I rewrite a TV pack for a web article.
Okay.
So a TV news pack, which is written for a person to read out loud. It's written for TV. It's the reporter. They're speaking and they've voiced it and everything. So I'm taking their script and I'm rewriting it in complete sentences. I insert quotation marks. I have to re- repurpose that and almost completely rewrite it. Not always, but you're keeping certain phrases and stuff. But yeah, it's the same thing. It's easier to start when you have something to work off of.
Yeah.
Your microphone isn't working for some reason. Did you turn it off?
How's that?
Did you try turning it off and on again? That always works in the IT crowd. It does work. I'm just saying. It works.
It's working.
Now it's not. Now it is working. I don't know why it wasn't before. So
I don't know. Okay, I blame society.
Okay.
But I got excited by that because that's essentially what a rewrite is. If you're, you know, this is not like what someone else might call a script doctoring. You know, it's not like I'm a big shot who came in to fix a broken script. This was part of a creative collaboration where the original writer was told, you know, we've got these notes and we're going to give this person a try on bringing those notes into the thing. And then when they're done, you're going to come in and do some dialogue pass and some other work. Like it was a part of a, like a friendly tennis match
sure.
of getting the story moving. Yeah. Right. So it's not a rewrite, but having the bones of someone else's idea all present and all their dialogue and all their things. Once we realized, and this is how we thought about it. The rewrite was about making different elements of the story rhyme with themselves, is how we talked about. That was our mission statement, right? And something rhymes with something else in prose, not in the literal sense where like the words match. But if you mention a red dress here, maybe you have a symbol of blood here later, and maybe you have something else that's with roses, and now you have three occurrences of the color red and three scenes rhyme with themselves, right?
Okay.
That's the idea. So this pass I did was about helping the existing story rhyme with itself a little bit better. And because I do so much
work.
So
not necessarily setup and payoff.
Right. Yeah. The setup and payoff was already on paper. But this was about going in and taking the existing story and making it more of what it already was.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Almost a distillation more than a rewrite. Which was a really interesting process for me to work from someone else's words,
mm-hmm.
have regular meetings with that director, and then boil down. And this is, you know, work we've done together before, so we have a little bit of a shorthand. We have a knowledge of the budget, which is very small in this project, and so it just keeps it all internal. And so this other person who had written the original hadn't worked with us before. And so this was just a way of us sort of bringing it back to what we knew how to do and then passing it outward outside of the circle that we're used to having. And then it comes back in. And it's been a really interesting challenge. But the whole time I was doing it, I was thinking about you and the Meat House script and how you liked our original thing. And you can, dear listener, can go and find the episode where we come up with it with Steven Kostanski. But you didn't like our finished one. You wanted to rewrite it in a new place and a new time.
Dead orphans.
Yeah,
I didn't want to do the orphan thing.
Yeah. But it's the same kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, no, it is. And I think like you doing that made that a much better script. Like that, it doesn't matter. You bring another person on to get another sense of like different options, and that's what that is, right? To get another set of eyes and yeah. another brain thinking
yeah,
about
I
it.
I love the meta film crew making a terrible horror movie. Yeah, in the, in
that's
the
still a
movie.
Thing. That's still
yeah.
very much a part
love
of this.
That.
My and honestly, I'm looking forward to just being able to sit down and write. I have yeah. not ever done that. I don't think where I've actually dedicated time to just writing. Although I write thousands of words a day for CTV.
Yeah,
it's not the same thing. It's like little short spurts of writing. So I'm really looking forward to getting down and sitting down and writing it. Just a matter of starting. That's really what it is. So I will, let me say this. I will start before next week. I'll start.
We'll text you from the road.
That's right. Oh yeah. Yeah. You guys won't even be here. So
we'll text
you. Okay. Let me say, I'll start before you come back.
Yeah.
When are you back? When
We're
you come back?
Back? May 5th, 6th.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That'll be fine. That'll be have time to finish marking my assignments and get a start on it. And I think that once I already have the opening scene in my head. Once that starts going, I think it'll just kind of flow out. And I probably will realize as I'm writing that I'm missing this element, I'm missing this, and I don't explain this properly. But that
yeah,
stuff all sorts itself out. Yeah,
don't
it all sorts itself out eventually.
I had an idea for the sequel.
Oh, God. I mean, we haven't even got the first one yet. Okay, go ahead, but yeah. I'm going to tie a rebuttal.
Well, and here's... I'm going to tie this all in together. I don't have an outline. I don't have an overarching idea. I have a scene. I have a really powerful scene.
You're that producer that comes in and says, we want a giant mechanical tarantula.
This is how stories are made, right? You think of a scene. You don't know what happens before and after, but that scene is amazing. Yeah, and so then you start building on, Up. I just listened to an interview with the guys who wrote Up. And it was just, we wanted an old man in a flying house. Well, how's the house fly? Okay, balloons. Okay. So why, what brought him to that? And then they worked backwards and got to that love story, right?
That sad love story. Everyone cries. But if you don't cry at the beginning of Up,
right,
you're probably a robot.
But that was like one of the, the first little puzzle pieces they figured out. But it started like flying house, old man, go.
Yeah, we talked about this as
what's your idea for
the
sequel?
Okay, so the monster in these movies is this, I think we kind of based it off of sea creatures that grow into shells.
Sure.
Right? Different, but in my mind, it's this fleshy, gooey, amorphous, blobby thing with eyes and teeth, but it doesn't have any shape. It kind of grows into its surrounding, right?
Diaphanous, perhaps?
Yeah. No, I don't know.
I don't know what that means.
What
$5 word?
Barnacle, the barnacles. You just see the little bit at the bottom of the whale, but its actual body is massive and inside. It's grown. It's veined into the whale. It's gross.
Ew. Yeah. So what happens with barnacles?
Yeah, they're gross.
Ew.
Yeah. If you want to look,
I did a lot of creepy barnacle research for Midnight City because the flesh trees grow first as these barnacle attachments onto the weird
heroes. I might
have
to work that in then somehow. Yeah, that's pretty gross.
Yeah.
So anyway,
this is going to be a gross movie for sure.
At the end of your movie, I don't exactly know how it's going to end, but let's say the protagonist somehow defeats the house, kill the monster, burn it down, blow it up, something. And then the second movie, scientists or some some nature surveyors, some scientists find a piece of this animal they don't recognize and they bring it back to the lab and they put it in a little box and it's still alive. They don't understand it. So they start to feed it and it gets a little bit bigger and they're starting to they're paying attention to this and they're trying to figure out
what my story break brain is kicking in. I have a plus one right now.
And at a certain point, so they don't know what this is. By the time they start to recognize this thing is dangerous, maybe we don't want it. Then we have the reveal that it's this little blobby monster, but it has this tiny little tail that has grown into the back of the box or the container.
That's what I was going to say is that my plus one is the box is put inside another box at one point. And when the creature breaks out, it fills the negative space between the two as if it was the walls filling up the walls of a house.
But it's already done that. We need the reveal of the one character following the tail of it and realizing it's actually the size of the room already.
Oh, it's already
filled up there, the walls of their lab or the ducts above them.
Right.
All the ducts above them are filled with it and they didn't realize. They thought it was just this little itty bitty thing. But
it's not too big a job for you, is it?
I'm just wondering if I don't need a bigger piece of bait.
Like who?
Well, I don't want to think about a sequel until I finish the first one. And the reason for that is because recently I just watched the G.I. Joe movies. Have you guys seen those movies? The G.I. Joe?
With
Channing Tatum.
Channing's Tatum.
Channing
Tatum.
Yes.
Don't they have the Iron Man suits in the first one?
Kind of, yes. Yeah. And so what I realized about it as I'm watching it, I actually haven't finished the second one yet. I got a DVD 2-pack out of the Walmart bin.
This is why.
So I realized as I'm watching it, first of all, there's no real attempt to connect it to the franchise that we know from our childhood, right? None of the vehicles looked like the toys. The characters had the names of the characters, and that was almost it. One of the planes. They had the stealth plane.
And
the Raven.
Snake
Eyes and Storm Shadow looked like they were supposed to. But what I realized is I started the second one, because the second one is better in a lot of ways. It's got The Rock. And they kill Channing Tatum about 20 minutes in. because I think they're always planning for it to become a bigger, like, I think what they're coming in with those movies, and maybe this is off of the success of the Transformers and all these Hasbro.
They were hoping it would grow.
They're trying to make their own cinematic universe, and I just think they overthought it, and they didn't put enough effort into that first movie to really make it. Like, they went ahead and made the second movie, but I don't think it was very successful.
Was there a Destro? Was there a Metal Face?
There's a Destro, yeah, but they spent all... It's Christopher Eccleston.
Oh, right.
And they spent all movie leading up to it. They don't reveal that he's Destro. I thought the guy who was supposed to be Cobra Commander, I thought he was Dr. Mindbender for the entire movie. Because he's got a thing over his eye, and he looks right. like Dr. Mindbender. And I'm like, oh, he's just not bald. And it turns out he is wearing a wig. He was bald, but it's Cobra Commander. Anyway, I'm on a tangent.
So, whoa. I've seen that movie, but I don't remember.
It's Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays Cobra Commander in the first movie. Yeah. Jeez. Crazy. And there's a weird Brendan Fraser cameo as well in that movie. Like, it's such a... Anyway, sorry. I'm off on a tangent. The point is, I'm not going to think about the sequel until the first one's done, but I like that idea. No. Yeah. I want to learn more about, like, the gross parts of anatomy, because I think you can incorporate... Let me give you the whole overrun thing that I have right now. So basically, it's about a film crew. They're going out to this lodge to shoot a movie. They meet at the lodge. They start shooting. They find the hidden room. We talked about this hidden room in the middle, the red room, and they immediately think, oh my God, this is amazing. We have to shoot here. This is
production
value. We have to start. We have to take advantage of this. So they rewrite the pages. They figured out, they start shooting. But while they're shooting in this room, something happens, and that reveals that the house is actually a monster, and that is this person who has been feeding the house and growing it between the walls, like you said. I did envision it actually looking like a house once it breaks free, so it won't be a blob. It will be shaped like the house. The monster will actually have that shape somehow.
Let me draw some things for you.
And then, but the what happens is, at the moment where, you know, oh my God, we have to run and get out of here, the whole house starts crumbling together and becomes the monster. So each room becomes like a stomach. Almost. So the whole thing becomes like this fleshy...
Imagine thing. A room slowly filling with stomach acid.
Yeah, acid.
Furniture and carpets are dissolving.
And then at that point, it kind of becomes like they have to figure out a way to get out. They have to make their way out, but also how to kill the monster somehow. And so it's going to be like really like claustrophobic kind of shooting, like very, very, like stuck in, almost like going through entrails and that kind of stuff inside the house. Will eventually get, the trick is to get out of the house to the work shed or the kill shed, right? We talked about where they actually, you know, got the deer and stuff. Get out there, get some explosives or something that they have ready for the movie that they're going to use for the movie, and then use that to blow up the
I had done
monster.
pre-production for an independent project that was tentatively called The Meat back in the day, which is a very different premise. The only connection between your idea and theirs is that there's meat in the title. It was like the idea of
working.
Like... almost a zombie virus, but rather than affecting people, it affects like the meat of a slaughterhouse, which forms into horrible creatures, and a little bit like The Thing. But
and it gets smarter the more it like patches brains and stuff together, right?
Yeah,
like
that was one of the ideas behind it. So I have a fair amount. I say all this to say that I have a fair amount of experience making meat-related creatures.
Yeah, I kind of figured you would.
And I could help you. Help you out.
Good. The idea for the sequel, I always love in monster movies, sci-fi and monster movies, where they have the laboratory scene where they are trying to figure out what this thing is.
I love autopsy scenes.
The autopsy
with creatures.
Scene. Yes. Like, oh my God, this does that. And look, oh my, it's evolved to do this.
Okay, let's do it. What are your favorite autopsy scenes? I'll start. The first time I ever felt that feeling of like, oh, xenobiology, they're opening it up, was literally in Aliens, where they're opening up the face hugger and the android is saying, you know, describing what the organs do and how it all works, and just lovingly and meticulously taking apart this. You know, I think it was like all chicken gizzards is what it actually was.
Yeah.
But that's not what it looks like. It looks like this spidery, horrible thing. Man, what about yours?
Blade 2 has a really good one.
Great autopsy. Guillermo del Toro loves his autopsy scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I would say, like, it's not a horror movie, but it is a horror movie. Silence of the Lambs has the best autopsy scene, I think.
See, but that's a real person.
What's that?
That's a person.
I know, but it's an autopsy scene. You asked me for autopsy scenes.
I know, but only
Lyndon has his hand
Lyndon
up.
In the back.
Spider-Man 2.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Spider-Man
that's right. The Sam Raimi, the arms and the Doc Ock. Is that?
Oh,
that's not an autopsy, though. That's like they're operating on him.
Yeah.
Oh, what's the difference?
It's the difference is that he's dead in an autopsy.
No, I like that though. Yeah. So
that's a good, that is a great scene.
But why they're good? Why they're good is that it's a pause where the audience,
the lights looks, are on,
looks on. Yep. There's nobody's looking away. It's over the shoulder, and we look into reality within unreality. You know, like the. Everyone loves world building when they're making up stuff. That's our favorite part. And so those autopsy scenes in monster movies are a way to justify the world building, to talk about some pseudoscience, to make some vague reference to how you understand biology. And all the MacGuffin is packed into the creature.
Crimes against Crimes of the Future.
Oh, yeah.
The entire
yeah.
movie is an autopsy
it's
scene.
It's just really an autopsy scene, yeah.
The Thing has some good ones, too.
Yeah, yeah well, there's and actually, I would say that the a recent episode of The Mandalorian did it as well, except for the... Remember the episode where the robots are going? I don't know if you guys ever watched it up on The Mandalorian.
Yeah, I saw it, yeah.
So the one that everyone got mad about with Lizzo and Jack Black. With that episode.
Good.
Well, people are upset about the casting, but yeah, whatever. Right. But they,
if anyone's happy anywhere, someone else is unhappy somewhere
true.
Else.
That's so, true. But they go and they have to figure out why these robots are malfunctioning. And then the code goes into the autopsy droid and it starts like shooting lasers.
That's right.
I thought that was really cool. And yeah. I like that character. I liked like even Men in what's Black.
That?
Now they're all coming back to me. Men in Black, the, what's her name? Who works in the,
oh.
in the morgue, right? She's a yeah. key
and
character.
It's a
was
robot.
That a midichlorian joke though? Was that what they were getting to?
Maybe.
When they had the little micro robots, you know, they're like micro machines. It's
oh,
basically
yes.
nanites, but they don't use the word nanites.
Yes.
But it's also like, I'm pretty sure that's them taking a shot at midichlorians.
It could be. Or also could be lazy writing because it's also the bad thing in G.I. Joe.
Oh, yeah. People love right. nanites. That's
well, they're invisible. You can't see them, so we don't have to animate them or yeah. create them.
There was that remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still. Nanites.
Yeah.
Nanites ate everything.
Yeah. They anyway. Were... Yeah, that's right. It was just like cloud.
It was a cloud of nanites.
Yeah, that was, I think, propagated by CGI finally figuring out how to do particle swarms and make them look semi-realistic. And so then there was a proliferation of science fiction movies that used that particle swarm effect.
Yep.
Yeah, tons. Okay, so... Bringing it all together, which
we've been
is
kind
usually
of all
my
over
job.
The place.
No,
so I'm
but
excited
we
to see how you do this.
We've been on a journey. So we talked first about packing up our whole circus and going on the road. And then you suggested that we should spend some time introspectively evaluating whether or not the destination that we're after is one we'll ever reach. And that brought us to Dan talking about a destination he wants to reach, which is a creative output, which got us talking about what are the constituent parts of those things. And the best thing about it, dear listener, was watching Dan's body language change from passive producer while we were talking about those scenes. When we started talking about his film, he leaned forward. He was leaning out onto his knees. He was into it. And we started putting the pieces together to make that story. He came alive because that's that paradox path we're talking about. You create it by walking it, right? Once your mind started putting those pieces together, you're creating and perceiving simultaneously. And that is what we're trying to do also, to create and perceive simultaneously in our jobs. Make a thing, decide what it is. Whatever that becomes, make the next thing that goes with it, and so on and so forth. And that is
also great being in like a room like this, having people not keep you accountable, but just like, you know, bring it up. Like you were going to work
no,
on that
cool
thing.
No, it is keeping you accountable.
Where, yeah, where's that thing you were talking about, Gregory? That was such a cool idea.
Yeah, whatever happened to that?
Whatever
yeah.
happened to that? Like, I think it's artists who work isolated, it's so easy to get excited about something for a couple days and then let it kind of fizzle out. And it dies because it's yeah. they never bring it up again and nobody around them.
One thing, our mission board, our action board, what do we call that?
Scrum board?
Our scrum board, our danger board, whatever we have it called in the
huge
studio.
Huge cork board full of Post-its with ideas on them.
Yeah, we have it sectioned. So there's things that are coming, things that are about to happen, things that are in process, and things that are finished. I rearranged all the finished tasks onto the bottom there. Yesterday, day before yesterday. So shout out to Lyndon for helping me accomplish all those things. But I was able to move some projects that have just been titles, ideas, those, whatever happened to that, Gregory,
right,
into the almost about to work on it phase.
Nice.
Where for me, it's about deciding I'm going to start making space in my imagination for this idea. So I move a little, all it is, how it exists in the world right now is a little like 3-inch by 4-inch piece of paper with the tack and the title on it, but it moves physically in space to the place that hovers above the tasks I have to accomplish. And that gets my subconscious working on like, well, how am I going to fill that up?
One rule. Stay in the light.
I had this idea the other day that stories are like dark rooms that you're in with a little candle. And when you first get in there, you can get a sense of what's going on, but you really can't see much. And the more you work on it is you traveling around that room with your little candle, revealing things, right? So, okay, it's a big dark room. I can kind of get a sense of the story. I have a bit of an idea in my mind.
I like this metaphor.
And as I go around, I'm getting details. Okay, there's a kitchen, there's a bed, there's windows over here. And you start to like get more familiar with the room the more you travel around with your little light, i.e., working on it, building scenes. And some stories, you have just this tiny little candle. And some stories, you go into that room with like a 10,000 lumen like.
Yeah, well, let's imagine. Light. I love this metaphor. I find it so delicious. I want to play with it a little bit. Mm-hmm. If the candle light on that candle represents, at least to me right now, represents my attention span, what I can accomplish in a certain set of attention, then if I open a door in my mind and I can see the back wall, I know I can just finish this today, right? Or finish this in the next week. But if it's cavernous, like you feel the wind like flutter at the candle and you know it's a huge space,
it's
you can't see
the wall.
Too
much to take in.
Too much today. It's too much for me today. I don't want to explore that. I can close those. That's kind of what the board is, right? There are certain things where I know I've got enough light to illuminate what I need to do, mm-hmm. right? So that I can move it in. That's a great metaphor.
Yeah. Cool. Just and
so where are you in the room of spark chasers? Right.
See
now.
That one, okay, and that's what I wanted to bring up. Like, so for example, we've been working on one book called Old Assault, Strongest of Sea.
That's right.
Which is a really big room, and we have two little candles in it, and we're slowly figuring it out. But it's been like kind of chipping away at it.
Justin, look over here.
Right.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah. Right. And like, you know, some parts of the story, we have a vague idea of how this is shaped, but we don't know because we haven't made it that part of the room yet.
There's something else over here, Justin.
And so that was the next project that was supposed to be on my slate. But then I stumbled into the Spark Chasers room and was handed a fucking beacon.
Yeah.
And suddenly I could see the whole room and I knew exactly the shape of it and how it was supposed to, like everything about it made sense and clicked. And so it got me really, really excited.
You just have to go in there.
I just have to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just have to look around in there. Yeah.
And so there's some ideas, some projects that like will take you a long time to really flesh out and figure out. And it's a little bit at a time. And then other projects just hit you in the face, like fully formed in your mind. And Dragon Nanny was like that too. The first couple versions where I felt like it was kind of stumbly.
Yeah.
And then like 3 years into the project, the last rewrite just like bam, it was clear as day. This is the book, and just like spilled out, and that was the final book. That last rewrite just became what was Dragon Nanny. And so it's just neat how some stories just take a long time to make sense, others just hit you fully formed.
If you use that room metaphor too of the lights, you know, your little candle, sometimes you go into a room and it's really big and you found some stuff in there, like if you imagine a you know, old attic full of antiques, right? You see some stuff you think is cool and you wish you could bring with you. Then you find a door, right, in the wall, and you haven't finished exploring the room. And when you open that door, you can see everything. And all you need to finish that other room is a few of the things that are in the room that you're leaving. Sometimes a big idea is just a conduit to that other one. And it's too big maybe for where you are now. But, you know, Chadwick and I talked about this off the podcast. As a writer, sometimes an idea is beyond you. And so you find yourself circling back to it and including a version of it in every new novel or every new project, just so that you can see if you can, using Justin's analogy, see the whole room at last. Like you're going back, retreading. And yes, people will say, oh, you know, Guillermo, there's always an autopsy scene in your monster movie.
It's like a Resident Evil game. You have to go to the other rooms and trip the breakers in four different rooms before you can go to that main room and turn the lights
turn
on.
Turn the lights on, yeah.
There you go.
Okay, now we're mixing our metaphors and we should wrap things up.
How many metaphors can be mixed in a single episode of Super Pulp Science? That's what we should ask ourselves right now. The other thing we should ask ourselves right now is when you get back from a 12, 14-day road trip, do you just have to collapse into a puddle? Or do you have a whole bunch of stuff you have to do when you get back?
I really like that first day or two back of just kind of puttering around and slowly unpacking and answering emails, but really not doing much else. I'm kind of emptying. Yeah, I empty my suitcases. I do my laundry. I clean my house. I answer emails.
Clean your house you haven't lived in for 2 weeks? Or was it dirty
before? I usually leave it as a mess because I'm scrambling up until when I leave.
Right.
But it's, I usually need a day or two of decompression. I also just spent 8 hours in a vehicle with this guy. So
I may have made a critical error because that week coming back, I'm going right into classrooms and doing some classroom work. School reached out to us to do some classroom story things and it's like, oh, we're on a book tour, which I think made us seem more desirable. Like,
oh,
no,
sure.
We're not available. We're on a book tour. Would you come back for these other dates, you know? Yeah. And
but, so for you, like, do you feel productive when you get back or is it like family time for a couple days and not working?
So it's complicated because I miss my family while I'm away. I miss spending time with my wife, with my kids. I miss all of that stuff. But usually what happens when we're on the road doing a tour like this is we are hyper-focused on what you kind of think of as like the storefront of your career, right? Making everything look nice for the people who come and go on the outside. And ideas pile
up. Come up with so many good ideas, yeah.
And particularly because we're spending evenings with very creative people, we're spending evenings without, at least in my case, without those normal family obligations. So my mind has the luxury of wandering, even if I'm exhausted. Like, you know, these are 14-hour, 15-hour days sometimes that we're working, and you come back to wherever you're going to sleep, but my mind can wander without those responsibilities. So when I come home, there's always a part of me that I have to pack tightly away that says, later, Gregory. You have all these ideas, but now is time to be present at home. Now is time to listen. I try to turn my listening side of myself and not the talking side of myself, not the presentation side, but the side that survives a relationship for 23 years, you know, with a person is you have to know when it's not about you. And we spend all these days where we get to put the spotlight on ourselves and other people are telling us how great our things are, whether they're great or not. You know, that's just what happens when you're in public. And so you have to kind of get the ego back under control and I have to go back into dad mode. It's a struggle those first few days back to just push that creative side of me, which has had free reign. Like there's plenty of times when we'd be out somewhere traveling and I'll say, okay, I'm ditching you guys. Taking my laptop, I'm going to this restaurant, I'm going to write for the next 8 hours, I have such a crazy idea. And they're like, what? Where'd that come from? I'm like, I don't know, but I'm just going to catch it, right? You don't have that freedom again once you're back.
Yeah.
So I try not to take it for granted when I'm away, but I also try not to take for granted that family that I have waiting for me when I get back. So it's a complicated relationship for me when I return from the road. And also, it's definitely my job to do all the laundry, all the dishes, make all the dinners for the next 14 days.
You had a couple of weeks off of doing
that's
that. Right. So, yeah, for sure. Cool. Yeah.
And I think, yeah, we always come back from these trips with, like, ideas for new posters, new stories. Like, we come with a laundry list of new projects. So I've actually been excited about the anticipation of the new project list that's going to, you know, evolve out of this trip and doing these conventions and seeing all the stuff that all these talented other artists have done. Like it's been like Calgary last year was still kind of like at the tail end of, you know, the
of
event.
A global event.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think this year we're going to see a real step up in people's portfolios and their tables. And I'm really excited to get Last episode, we talked about how inspire is just a fancy word for jealous. But I'm excited for that, like, jealous rage of, oh, my God, that's amazing. I need to do something, like, equally amazing that that person did.
I have to say I'm really proud of the stuff we're bringing with us, though. Like, I think it's important to point out that a bunch of the ideas that we had a year ago now exist as comics and books that we're bringing back to the place where we had the idea. And it's such a wonderful circuit to, like, you know, what was the name of that delightful coffee shop restaurant in Saskatoon?
Saskatoon. I know how to get to it. I don't know what it's called.
Like a pirate's den, but like, what was that place?
It's in Saskatoon. It's on one of the main streets. It has a second floor balcony, lots of plants. If you're in Saskatoon, I'm sure you know exactly what we're talking about, but we don't.
Oh no, it's snowing outside.
No.
Spring's over. In fact, summer's over here in Winnipeg. I'm the first to report. Breaking news, summer's over in Winnipeg.
That coffee shop was also beside the lawn ornament graveyard.
Yes, that's right.
It's just like a city block worth of like stone angels and flamingos. And gargoyles. And like, but all stone, all gray stone.
Yeah.
Iron rot. It was
it's like the beginning of a good story.
Yeah.
Well, speaking hopefully you are at the beginning of a good story, dear listener. This has been Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how a genre gets made. If you are on your own paradox path, remember, you make your story by walking that path. You make the path by walking it. This has been Super Pulp Science. I am Gregory Kamichuk, encouraging you to join the fight and make comics. Thank you.